welcome Brian Kay from the Stepping Stones.
Good evening, everybody. Hi, my name is Brian Kennedy. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hello, Brian.
Thanks to the group for having me out. I know Shay said she's going to be online, so thanks, Shay, for asking me to come out on a Monday night here in Quakertown. For some reason, I thought this group was like in Port Fishington or something like that, and I had like a 25-minute drive, and then thank God I looked at it at like 5 o'clock. I don't know if my clothes match. My 4-year-old son dressed me before I left. He wanted me to wear a Frank Sinatra sweatshirt and something else, but I told him I couldn't. It's good to be out here. Welcome, Matt, you know, and my job tonight is to, share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys, tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like today. First off, I have a sobriety date, which is April 4th of 2010. It's the last Monday. I celebrated 12 years, which is neat. Thank you. And as you, Athea, read the set-aside prayer, I try to think that way, like every time I have an anniversary, because if I ever come to a place where I think that I have this thing, it's like the scariest place in the world for me to be. I think the most important thing, anytime I have an anniversary is to quickly recognize that I am still a student. I love to learn this thing. I love the process of it. Just taking layers of the onion constantly, and it's awesome. As mentioned, I have a home group, which is Stepping Stones in Northeast Philadelphia. My specific group is on Friday nights at 10 p.m. It's a double speaker meeting. Been my home group for about 7 years. I have a commitment at that group, which is the Speaker Seeker. I've been doing that for about 6 years. I think it's a 2-year commitment, and I'm really waiting for somebody to take it off of me at some point. I love it. Getting up there a little bit in age, 10 o'clock on a Friday night, it's getting a little later and later for me, but it does allow me to put my kids to bed on Friday and make the meeting, which is cool. I have a sponsor, active communication with that sponsor. I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring other men. And I get to do some pretty cool stuff otherwise. I'm involved in a lot of H&I. I'm involved in a great deal in a treatment center that I went through 12 years ago, giving back to those patients. I sit on different task force in my area to try to combat some the things that are going on in this world. I own Independence Lodge Sober Living in Bucks County, which are recovery houses, so I get to work with alcoholics on a regular daily basis, which I love most days. these greys are from those guys, I think. No, I love them. They're all sitting in a big book meeting right now with my friends Ricky D and Marie K. They're breaking down the book for them tonight. So let's get into, me qualifying, why I'm here today. So I grew up in Westchester, Pennsylvania, in Chester County. Some of you guys will know the show Jackass and put that on the map because of that. But yeah, grew up in Westchester. My father grew up in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. My mother in Drexel Hill. Most of you will know where Pottsville is because it's home of Yingling, the oldest brewery in America. My dad's father was a postal worker. Died of a heart attack at the age of 42. So my dad was pretty young when his dad passed away. My dad was in college at the time. Took a job at Yingling, working 50, 60 hours a week so he could take care of his mom, and his younger brother, who was one of us. Just kind of thrown into maturity and responsibility at an early age. He would go on to become like the CEO of a hospital for 40 years. As a young kid, I'm looking at this guy who's like Superman to me. And I'm thinking, like, holy cow, like, there's a really big shoes I have to fill. And I felt a lot of pressure, early in life looking at that. But this guy was, like, a workaholic. He never stopped. Back then, before laptops came about, like, he'd come home from work, like, eat dinner, go to his briefcase, do paperwork until, like, 11 o'clock, watch the news, flip through the channels till midnight and do it again the next day. Like, never stopped. And I didn't really understand that. I'd love to sit here and tell you that, like, I had a real, crazy childhood, maybe like with abusive parents or things were really bad, and maybe that's what led me to drink the way that I did, but that'd be a lie. You know, I had a loving environment. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. I grew up in a, you know, a double cul-de-sac neighborhood, you know, like 18 houses that were all, you know, kind of cookie-cut houses. You walked in, the living room was to the right, the kitchen was straight ahead, there's a family room back on the left, and it was like a four-bedroom, two-and-a-half-bathroom house. And most of the houses, you walked in the front door and you turned left, and there was like a playroom. And you walked in my front door and you turned left, and there was like a six-inch thick wood, dark wood door with this metal latch, and you open that up, and it was, you know, orange and yellow and brown wallpaper, and, you know, we had a bar in there. You know, we had a tile bar, we had a beer meister, we had, and there was like little tables with candles, there was a black and white TV in the corner, and, you know, in the colder months, that's where my parents, entertained. You know, neither one of my mother or father are alcoholic, but growing up, you know, in the 80s, you know, in the summer months, it was trash cans that were cut in half, and it was kegs of beer outside, and all the neighbors, and all the family, and tiki torches, and a lot of classic rock. And in the colder months, they were hanging out in that bar. And, from an early age, I watched these adults with these, you know, these red plastic cups, or these, you know, rocks glasses of brown substance in it. And I watched them drink what was ever in those cups, and I saw that it created a lot of happiness and a lot of laughter, you know, when they drank it. And, you know, from that age, I was very curious and kind of looking forward to the time in life that I would be old enough to be able to drink whatever was in those cups so that I could laugh and smile like they were. And, I can remember maybe being like, you know, 9 or 10 years old. It was summer, and, my grandmother was out by the pool, and she had an empty pitcher, and she said, "Why don't you be a good boy and go fill this up for grandma?" And of course, I wanted to be a good boy. And, you know, so I walked into that room, and I saw them like that. They pulled that lever, and you had to put it on a tilt. Don't get too much white stuff on the top, whatever. But, you know, 9 or 10 years old, you're not that big. And God forbid, I don't want to spill anything on mom's carpet. So I do remember, you know, taking a couple steps. It's pretty heavy. And, you know, I took a couple sips of it. And I love the taste of beer from the moment I taste it. I'm not one of those alcoholics that just said, "Oh, I hate it, I'm just going to drink it for effect." And obviously that age, I didn't know at one point I'd be drinking it purely for effect, but I liked the taste of it from the moment I tried it. I think I did normal things in life as I grew up, you know, grade school and the high school, you know, I hung out with my buddies on the weekends in the woods, you know, and drank a lot of real classy beer like Natty Ice and Milwaukee's Beast and the good stuff, you know, Bankers Club stuff that they told you would put hair on your chest and things of that nature. I think I was grounded like 75% of my high school years because I would come home and my dad would be sitting there with his briefcase and, you know, those little Ben Franklin glasses, and he would look above the glasses and he would see the shape that I was in, and I was caught all the time. You know, I spent a lot of time being grounded, and, but, you know, I remember, I think, you know, again, like probably 13, 14 years old, you know, all the kids that I grew up with were mostly public school kids, and they were all a couple years older than me. So they're bigger, you know, like you're picking sides to play football or basketball in your neighborhood. And being younger, you're normally picked last, you know, and that did affect me, you know, like I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to be part of. These guys were smooth. They could talk to girls. I was petrified of girls. But one Friday night, they called me and they said, "Hey, listen, like all of our parents are going out to dinner tonight. We're going to come over to your house and we're going to hang out in that room and we're going to bring girls." And I was like, "Okay, cool." And they came over, and I had watched Cheers before. So I got behind that bar and made God knows what concoctions for everybody. Probably cream de menthe, grenadine, Jim Beam, I don't even know. But I handed them all out, and I poured myself a big one. And I'm not going to say that I like the taste of whiskey at that age. But a few minutes later, that feeling, you know, that came over me, that feeling of warmth and content and confidence, you know, I quickly fell in love with that emotion. And I wanted more of it, you know, and I became like the guy that I wanted to be internally, and how I socialized with people. And from that moment on, I knew that I had this new solution that I was looking for. And so, you know, from then on, wherever I went, alcohol was coming with me. You know, I would go into the recyclable bin in the garage and get like empty 2 liters out of there, and I'd fill it up off the Beermeister and, you know, find a cap and I'd put it in a school bag and take it with me wherever I was going. And, you know, life just became easier. You know, I drank and I was sociable and, you know, whatever. And, it affected my grades, you know, but not so much then. I was involved in sports. I was involved in student council. I played soccer in high school. I was a goalkeeper, played rugby. Got a scholarship to Bloomsburg University for soccer. Go up there, you know, you're supposed to actually, you know, attend classes and you're supposed to go to practice to keep this scholarship. You know, but dad's not there with his Ben Franklin glasses anymore to see the condition that I'm in when I'm coming into my dorm. And, you know, I'm running with that. I'm finding that these upperclassmen, you know, they're fond of me because of the way that I can drink, you know, that I can outdrink like all the other, you know, younger classmen or whatever you call it. But I'm there for about 2 semesters, you know, and my drinking basically cancels that whole opportunity for me. I think I had a talk with like the head of discipline for like the 4th time. And, it was one of those occurrences where he said, listen, we either have to call the police this time, you know, or we just kind of, we say our goodbyes at this time. And, I knew what that was hitting for. So I said, I'll collect my things and I'll be on my way. And, you know, I called my father and I said, hey dad, you know, I've once again failed at something else. You know, can you come get me? And, he took that 2-hour ride up and he collected me and my things. And I don't think we said 2 words to each other on the way back, you know, just the embarrassment and shame that I felt on that ride back. And that was just the story of my life most of the time. And, came back to the area, community college. We were out to dinner one night, waiting for a table, my mom and dad and sister and I. And my dad points to the bartender and says, you know what? This would be a great idea for you. You know, maybe you should get a job as a bartender. And like, all I want to do is make this guy proud, maybe have a friendship with him one day, you know, these things, any type of relationship. So I'm like, all right, cool. I'll try to do that. And, I get a job as a bar back and, you know, they're training me to become a bartender. I'm a very good alcoholic. So I go up the street to the beer distributor and I get a part-time job there so I can learn more and more about these micro beers and stuff. And I eventually start bartending and, not a very good job for the alcoholic in my variety. You know, I come into work, people get inebriated on the other side of the bar and I want to murder every single one of them. You know, I just don't recognize that. I don't know that I'm not okay sober. Obviously I realize that I have a plethora of liquor on my side of the bar. So, you know, we drink and that became my lifestyle. I would, you know, wake up, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and, go to work at 4:30. By the time I get into work, my hands would be shaking a little bit. I would pour myself, you know, 20-ounce glass of Belvedere or the, you know, the good stuff since it was free, and I'd take 2 straws and I'd tuck one or two of them down and the shakes went away. And I would drink all night, you know, and then you would shut the doors at 2 o'clock in the morning and you would have your happy hour and you would do that until, you know, 5:30 in the morning. And, you know, you'd race home and get in bed before the birds started chirping and the sun came up, you know, and that was the story of my life. And I did that for years. I swore that I started to grow fangs in my mouth. I hardly saw daylight. Family, friends come into the picture telling me that I have a problem. I don't think that I do. I drink just like my friends, get off my back, you know. It's just, they won't stop. They won't stop. They won't stop. Eventually, like, I just give in and I say, okay, fine. You know, I'll go to one of these rehabs just to get them off my back. I go in there. I don't want to identify with anything that they're saying, but problem is that I do hear things that I can relate to. And somehow, some way, like a seed is planted. And what it really did was it really screwed with my drinking when I left there. I go out and as the big book talks about, I had the great obsession to be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And, you know, why do I have these friends? Why do I have these friends that can, you know, call me and say, hey, let's meet up at Duffer's at 7:30. And they can drink 2.5 beers from 7:30 until 9:52 and look at their watches and be like, oh, my gosh, I got to get out of here and go home and get some sleep and get up tomorrow for work. Like, if they could do it, like, why couldn't I? I'll go out in the parking lot and I'll get in my car when they're all leaving and I'll wait until they all pull out of the parking lot and then I'll turn my car off and then I go back in the bar and I close the bar. Like that's just, but I so badly wanted to be like a normal drinker like them and I just didn't comprehend as to why willpower couldn't allow me to do that. But my negative consequences continue to get worse and worse and I'm losing jobs and I'm losing friends and, You know, I'm up to a point where I'm drinking two handles of vodka a day. You know, I'm waking up with convulsions. And Bill's nightmare, he talks about taking sedatives to try to curb the amount of alcohol he had to drink. I'm trying to do that so I didn't have to drink as much. I'm, you know, putting pills in my system, and I'm throwing them up, and I'm retrieving them in the toilet. I mean, it was just chaos. You know, I try to do a geographical change. You know, they want to send me to Florida because that's going to be the answer. I think that White Sands and Blue Waters is going to be what, you know, AA is going to, you know, the cure down there. No, I go down there and I find the next best thing. That's a relationship in early recovery, right? You know, I meet her in my IOP, you know, on the third day into my recovery house by our third date. And by third date, I mean like a dark area on the beach, kissing, you know, all that stuff. And I think we have like our kids' names picked out, and like the house and where the hammock's going to go. I mean, like a good alcoholic. She quickly becomes my sponsor, my higher power. You know, I'm going to a different fellowship, you know, so that I can, you know, show everybody that she's my property, and, you know, just crazy. And I stay somehow abstinent from alcohol for a period of time. I you know, I'm living in a halfway house, and I have to get a sponsor. You have to get a home group. But I absolutely half measures, if that. You know, I'm meeting with this sponsor. I'm doing the absolute bare minimum just basically to allow myself to stay in this recovery house. You know, I mean, I remember doing like my sex conduct and not looking at it at all, just to race out of there and be with her. You know, I didn't do any work really. You know, I do recovery house, sober house. I end up getting a dog, and sober house won't allow me to keep this dog. So I get a real estate agent. I get a house in West Palm Beach, and she and I, you know, move in together. And, you know, I remember, you know, I came home from work one day, like 3 hours, 3 hours early, and I walked in the house, and there she was drinking, you know. And I hadn't been to a meeting. I wasn't helping any other alcoholics. I was just working and just, you know, up to my own defenses, nothing. And I sat down right next to her, and I began drinking. And things got bad real fast. I'm trying to get it together down there. I'm trying to put myself in detoxes. Coming back to the house, my neighbors are knocking on my door with, you know, with alcohol. They're like, hey, man, you know, just like... and I'm thinking now that, you know, Florida's the problem. Like, let me get the heck out of here and go back to Westchester. And, you know, again, I come back to the area. I think that, you know, I can stay abstinent and go to Duffer's and drink soda and eat buffalo wings and watch Phillies games. That lasts about 5 days. And, you know, it gets back to the chaos. And, you know, just the way that I was drinking back then, I was really reflecting on my anniversary. I mean, it was like, you know, if I didn't have alcohol in the house, you know, I wasn't really sociably drinking anymore. I mean, I would go to these hole-in-the-wall bars where, like, the intent was to not know anybody, you know. And I would go into this one place, you know, they had, like, 50 cents Pat's Blue Ribbon, you know, whatever. And, like, I remember people, like, trying to talk to me, and I was so uncomfortable in my skin. There could have been, like, ballerina competition on TV. And I just looked so intently at that TV because I didn't want anybody to talk to me until I had, you know, 10 or 12 of those mugs of beers. And then it was like, all right, man, like, what did you say? Like, that's just how much, you know, like, I couldn't do anything without alcohol. April 3rd, 2010, I woke up. I was shaking like a leaf. I drank a handle of vodka. I realized that those shakes would come back in time. I normally had like a backup bottle of pop-ups in case there was a blizzard in July or something like that. And I didn't. So I knew I had this woman calls me, and she was one of these people that I drank with at Duffer's, and she was one of these like one and a half Bud Lights and like a fuzzy navel type of woman. And she was from Texas, and she said, have you ate anything in the last 2 weeks? And I said, no. I said, I don't want anything to absorb my alcohol. She said, I really think you need to eat. I'm going to go to the grocery store and get you some food. And I was like, oh, that'd be great. I said, and, you know, the state store is like four spots down from Gennardi's. If you could stop there and get me a bottle of Smirnoff, that would be great. And she said, no, like, I can't do that for you, but I'll get you food. And I think I said, you will, and you'll like it, or something real rude like that. And she showed up at my house with like $200 worth of groceries and no vodka. And I had choice words for her again. And I got in my car and I drove to the state store. And after that, it gets pretty fuzzy. And I apparently hit another car with people in it. I have no recollection of it. I jumped over the median on a highway. Drove up the wrong side of the street. I came to a shuttering stop at an intersection. I slammed my head on the steering wheel. I heard people yelling and screaming, and I looked up and I saw like smoke billowing out from underneath the hood. And I realized it would be a third DUI, and I had been to jail for the second one, and I didn't like the green ham and the green turkey and things like that, and a 1-inch mattress on the cold metal slate. So I opened the door and I saw woods, and I fled into the woods, and I was running through prickle bushes. I was running into fallen trees. I heard the police sirens. I was like diving in ditches and rubbing mud on my face like Rambo. It was chaotic and just, you know, running, sprinting. I made it all the way to Westchester East High School where there was no trees but a football field. I did that 100-yard dash pretty fast. Made it all the way back to my father's house. Did not want to, think about what had just transpired. So, you know, what do I do? I drank. I had to break into his liquor cabinet because that's where I was in this life, you know. What I wouldn't find out for another 28 days was that about 45 seconds after I fled from the scene of the car exploded. Muffler was dragging, hoses had come undone, you know, so they said if I would have hit my head a little harder, I wouldn't be here. The next day was Easter Sunday. You know, my mom woke me up by phone call at like 5:30 at night. She said, "Where are you? You know, you ruined another holiday. The police call, they're looking for you again. Brian David, you know, what are you going to do?" And you know how it is when they drop the middle knee. What I said to my mom was like, you know, I've been trying to do this for so long. You know, I've been trying to successfully drink for so long. I tried to just drink Pinot Grigio, or I tried to just drink beer instead of vodka, and all these avenues, and I just continued to fail and fail and fail, and it just continues to get worse and worse. And you know, I said, I need help again, you know, and, my dad's neighbor came over. My dad wasn't around. He was like down in Florida somewhere, and they hid me in their basement because they were worried the police were coming. And they made a phone call and they got me into this treatment center called Miramont. I walked around that place for like the first 12, 14 days with my chin on my chest with a disposition of like, why are you people even trying? You know, like, I'm not even worth your efforts. I'm just a wart to the world. I'm going to fail again. Just completely filled with embarrassment, shame, remorse, guilt. This woman, who's a really dear friend of mine today, she was the clinical director of that place, and she finally got me on day 12 or 14, and she was like, "What is this look? You know, do you have a DeLorean parked outside, you know, that can take you back in time and change anything? No. You know, like, are you finally broken enough? Are you finally willing to start saying yes to all the things that you had said no to before? Are you finally willing to start to make some changes that you have been open to before?" And I didn't have an answer for it yet, but that night I went into the bathroom of my rehab room, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. It was a rough one. I mean, the amount of alcohol I was drinking, the nursing staff had to stick me with a needle in my butt for like the first 12 days because I couldn't stop vomiting. My DTs were so bad they had to put cooking mitts on my hands with duct tape because I couldn't stop scratching. I was like cutting myself. I was going through it so bad. And, I'm in this tub, you know, freezing, sweating. You guys can probably relate. And, hot water, cold water. And, everybody else in this facility is asleep. And, I'm just laying my head on the back of this tub and I'm looking at the sky. And like, for the first time in my life, like, I had no more answers. And I always thought that I could figure this out on my own, and I looked up to that ceiling and I just burst into tears and I just said, "God, I can't do this anymore. Please help me." That was my prayer, you know. I had 12 years Catholic education, whatever, but like that was just this heartfelt, "I can't do it anymore." And for the first time, I'd been there in 14 days. I got out of the tub, I laid in the bed, the first time I slept since I was there. The next day, you know, like these lectures that were going on, I just had a different state of mind. I started to listen. I saw new people coming into the facility looking just as scared and broken and anxious as I was. So I started walking up to them and introducing myself and showing them around. They eventually got to a place where they started talking to me about what I was going to do when I left treatment. Talked to me about going to a recovery house in, Bucks County, Levittown, which I had heard nothing about ever. I thought there was going to be deer antlers on every wall of every establishment. And that's why it was called Bucks County. But fear, anxiety, you know, like, what am I signing up for here? My dad picked me up from treatment, was pretty pissed off, took me by the police impound to show me the condition of my potato chip looking crisp car. I threw up when I saw that, realizing, like, you know, that's how close I came to death. Took me out to a recovery house, a couple guys came out, grabbed my bags, brought me in, talked to me about regular stuff at first, sports, music, whatever. I'm like, okay, these guys seem pretty cool. they told me to get situated in my room. We were going to eat dinner. Came out, it was like grilled chicken, asparagus, mashed potatoes. I was expecting ramen noodles or something. And then they said, hey, listen, like, get washed up. We're going to take you to a meeting. And they took me to a meeting, and there was like 130 people at this meeting. There was all these people in the parking lot, like, laughing and smiling. I was like, what is wrong with these people? Like, you can't be happy and sober. Like, why are they laughing and smiling? Speaker was sensational. I could relate a lot. You know, he had just celebrated 5 years. I was like, holy cow, like, that's possible. Went out, you know, for wings and pizza afterwards. And then these guys took me back to this recovery house, and these three guys specifically sat me down that night at like 10 o'clock. And they explained to me that they had, like, you know, 7 months, 9 and a half, and like 11 months sober, you know, where they were, you know, all had sponsors, were all actively working the 12 steps, talked to me about these home groups that they had, the commitment to these home groups. And again, you know, they're leaning back in their chairs and they're laughing and they're smiling. And initially I'm like, this is bad. I got to call my mommy. Like, these guys are clearly drunk. You know, like, you can't be happy like this. Like, what am I going to do? The owner of that recovery house called the manager that night and said, hey, listen, I want you to do a bunch of random urine tests tonight. And the guy tested like 75% of the house, including these three guys. And they're all sober. And I'm sitting back like, wait. Like, so you haven't drank anything and you're happy. And, you know, I don't know if the picture's in here anywhere, but if you look at, you know, Bill Wilson, the doctor of self-work, sitting next to, you know, Bill Dobbs, who's regarded as AA number three in that picture. You know, Bill Dobbs' whole disposition again was like, if these two guys can do it, then why can't I? And when I saw these guys that were, you know, 7 months and 9 and a half months and 11 months sober and actively going through their steps and everything that they were doing and that they were happy, it was, if these guys can do it, why can't I try to do it, whatever they're doing? And that's what I did. I emulated everything they did. These guys said we're going to a speaker jam in Wilmington, Delaware. I got in the back of a car. If they said we were going to New York to a meeting, I got in the car. A guy walked into that house the third day that I was there. A guy was like 375 pounds, was like 6'11", opened the big book and, you know, deciphered the big book for us that night. I was so intimidated by this guy. I was like, all right, I guess I have to ask this guy to be my sponsor. He handed me a big book, told me to read the first 164 pages. I said, all right, I'll see you in 2 weeks. He's like, I'll see you in 2 days. I'm like, okay. And that guy just, you know, he took me through this experience and, you know, we had this relationship and, you know, I remember even like, you know, in him telling me about like, you know, I was going to do my fifth step, but there was things that I was going to be uncomfortable to tell him that I could go to a priest and, you know, doing that fifth step with him and I'm going down that list and, you know, he could relate and I did this and I did that. And, you know, I ended up telling him everything. And, he was an older guy. He ended up having a massive heart attack a couple years later and passed on. And, you know, I've had 7 different sponsors in my 12 years. Not that anyone ever failed me, but I've always looked to have different experiences, you know, with different people. But he was my first. He took me through this work. I got an awesome home group that I loved. I got a coffee commitment. It was called the Bikers Meeting in Levittown. You know, I started to recognize that, you know, a big part of the meeting is that 30 minutes before and after. I went back in time in my head of times, you know, that I try to go to meetings on my own and, you know, they tell you to get your hand up and say that you're new, you know, and my hand was like 500 pounds. It was not going up. You know, I go outside after the meeting and there's, you know, people around my age standing in a circle smoking, drinking coffee. I'm holding up the brick wall 20 feet away, like just petrified with fear, can't engage, you know, this sucks and I leave. But recognizing like today that like, you know, we have to be the change and learning like, you know, I'm at these meetings and seeing those people that were me and walking up and extending my hand and introducing myself and, you know, I eventually started sponsoring other guys. I fell in love with AA. You know, I fell in love with this whole process. I put myself around the right people. I remember being in, the house for like 60 days, a very dear friend of mine today, a guy named, you won't mind me saying his last name, Robbie Walker, came into my life. Robbie came up to me and said, how you sleeping? I said, like, crap. And he said, you know, do yourself, you know, a favor and like go through those steps. A clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. I didn't grasp exactly what he was saying, but, you know, he hit it on a T. I mean, you know, if you haven't gone through the work, you know, when I got to my amends process and, you know, basically made all the amends that people were open to, man, you know, my conscience, like I just was able to then like put my head on a pillow at night and I was asleep, you know, 60 seconds, you know, it was great. Conventions, you know, traveling all over the place. I've been to conventions in Hawaii and Texas and, you know, just, I mean, friends in AA that are in Sydney, Australia and Russia and Ireland, you know, like you just, I started in this small little bubble in Levittown, and it grew to Philadelphia and Delaware and Quakertown and all over the place, and then it expanded. And again, I thought like AA was going to be, okay, I'm going to go to sober dances every weekend, and I can't dance, and I'm going to be in like 4 different bowling leagues, and you know, I'm going to own like every DVD that was ever made in the history of mankind. I'm going to know, like, I thought that's what sobriety was going to be, you know, and like, it just, my life filled up so fast. You know, today, you know, as I mentioned, like I have 2 and 4 year old children. I have a daughter that's 2. My son will be 5 in May. Like, you know, on my 12 year anniversary on Monday, when I was taking them out of my truck in the daycare, like I was just, my eyes were filled with tears. They had no idea, you know, why, but it's just like they are miracles to me, you know, that they are alive and that I get to be the type of father that I am today. The look on my parents' faces when they get to hold their grandkids, like, you know, I didn't think that that was ever going to be a possibility. I get to be a son. I get to be a brother. My father, unfortunately, is in early stages of vascular dementia right now, and it's heartbreaking to me. You know, I had no relationship with this guy, you know, and, you know, I got sober. He was actually my business partner. I remember like when we opened like our third house and we were doing the meeting that's going on right now on a Monday night. I took a picture of all the back of their heads and I sent my dad a text and I said, hey dad, thanks for helping me get this thing started and believing in my mission and doing this. And, you know, he sent me a text back and said, you know, Brian, I'm so proud of you. And I had to like walk out of the back of that annex and sob like a baby because that's all, you know, I ever wanted to do was like maybe make my dad proud and have a relationship, you know. But my mom apologizes to me on a regular basis because of how much I have to do for my father right now. And it's like, mom, like, thank God in AA that I'm in a position to be able to show up for my father the way that I am right now. It's trying, but you know, talk about like love and tolerance is our code. It is in so many factions of life. I get to do this work, you know, I get to sponsor guys. I have family that sometimes ask me as the years go on, like, do you still have to go to those meetings? You know, it's like, yeah, I still have to go to those meetings. We still have to carry this message. We still have to extend our hand to the newcomer. I say to the guys in the house all the time, like, always be nice to the newcomer. You never know. Maybe you're sponsor one day. And that's, you know, what we do. There's times anymore that it gets difficult when you have young kids to do, you know, AA the way that I used to do AA and traveling, you know, they become a priority and obviously, but you know, sometimes, you know, my wife will say, hey, I have to go speak tonight. I'm not going to be here for dinner to put the kids to bed. And she gives me a look and she's an AA. And it doesn't take long for her to come back and be like, hey, you know, my bad. I know that we have to continue to do this. So, you know, our kids never see us strong. But it's balance, you know, and I do the best that I can at it. What else? 8:40. I guess, yeah, amends is huge. If you haven't gone through it, like do that vigorously. Fourth and fifth step, like I said, like different times before, really half measures. And, you know, most of the time when I interview guys that are coming to the houses, I'll ask them to say, you know, have you had any experiences through the steps? Most people will answer that they started to write a 4-step and they stopped, or they got to their amends and they stopped, and that's when they drank again. And that seems pretty straightforward to me. I'll finish with this. I go to different professionals weekends to learn like how to be better at what I do for a living. And a couple of years ago, I had to go to this one in Nashville, Tennessee, and it was cool, good food. Good people, but you know, there was like maybe 30 of us at this treatment center down there, and most of them, I think all of them, were all clinicians of some sort, and I'm the only you know, sober living owner down there. So every one of the lectures and practices you had to do, you had to sign in, and so all these people are writing like, you know, Sue Ellen, like CCN and all these, and I'm just like Brian Kennedy, AA. You know, and but I'm learning a lot and everything that we're doing. And you know, the Saturday night came, and they told us that we were going to do this thing called the maze. And they explained to us that we were going to be blindfolded, that we were going to be led into a maze, that our hands were going to go onto rope, that, you know, the goal was to find our way out of the maze. They told us we needed anything we could ask. And, you know, immediately for me, it was, you know, ego, 197 miles an hour. I'm going to be the first person to find my way out of this maze. You know, you got all these licensed clinicians and everything. And, you know, I'm going to show them. And, They tell us to be careful of rattlesnakes and stuff. So they blindfold us and they put our hands onto the shoulders of the person in front of us, and they lead us into this maze, and they put our hands on the rope, and pretty quickly I can feel that there's carpet underneath my feet, so the fear of rattlesnakes goes away. But, you know, here we go. Like, I'm gonna figure out this, getting out of this maze faster than anybody, and we begin this journey, and I'm walking through this maze, and I'm running into intersections of rope, and I'm running into walls, and after like 10 minutes of doing this, I'm like, these guys are messing with us. There is no exit out of this maze. What is this practice? And, you know, a few minutes later, I hear the facilitator say, you know, this young lady has found the exit. And I'm like, what? You gotta be kidding me. You know, like, all right, I didn't figure it out. And somebody else figured it out first. And, you know, but I'm like, all right, I guess there's an exit. Like, you gotta figure this out. And I'm in here and I'm, you know, going back to these intersections of rope and I'm running into walls and I'm trying to figure this out. And, you know, this man has found the exit and this woman has found the exit, and I'm losing it. And I'm getting so frustrated. Like, dude, like, why can't you figure this out? And I come to a point, you know, I'm like, well, they said that I could raise my hand and ask for something. And I'm like, all right, I guess maybe I'm supposed to ask for a pair of scissors. You know, maybe I could ask for a map. You know, and I pause and I kind of think about everything I've learned in this whole process. And I raise my hand and the guy comes over and he says, yes. And I said, I need help. And he said, this man has found the exit. My name is Brian. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.